Such a privilege to have with us tonight Brandon Coons. Some of you know Brandon a lot better than I do, and yet I've known or seen Brandon and been around him for 10 years or 15, as long as my kids have been around, I guess. I believe a graduate of, name escaped me, the Wesleyan School of Milton. And that's where you graduated from, didn't you? Yes. And then Houghton College, and back in the area, married Scott and Crystal's daughter, Ashley. And that's great. Let's welcome Brandon as he comes to share tonight.
So I am Scott Schombach's son-in-law. And he gave me this bit of wisdom before I start, and that is if I don't hit oil within the first 10 minutes of mining, that I should stop. I don't know what that means, but I guess I've got 10 minutes. So quit boring. Oh, quit boring. Oh, not mining. So if you're asleep, I apologize. I hope I last longer than 10 minutes before y'all doze off. But a few months ago, Pastor Krell had asked if Scott and I would come and speak, and Scott and I had not really talked about what we were going to talk about. There was no sort of collaboration going on here, but it's funny how Pastor Krell had kind of talked about us originally doing 4 weeks so we'd have an opportunity to work out a series with you guys and work through some subjects together, but it turned out Scott did 2 weeks and I have 2 weeks, and we all end up kind of did a series regardless. And so I just love the way that the Lord worked that out. There was no discussion, but we still have the same, we're still trying to drive home the same kinds of points. And actually, he started stealing some of my illustrations last week, and I said, you can't talk about that. You can't talk about that way. But if you'll indulge me, I'd like to tell you a story about a young boy. His father was in the military, and just like many military families, they moved around because you go where the commanding officers tell you where you need to go. You go where you're needed, and so they did this for a number of years because of this. They never formed very strong relationships. They never put down roots until at a certain point, Dad says to the family, I'm done, we're out, and I'm going to move you home to where I grew up, what I call my homestead, right? So they get out of the military and they go back to this place. And as you can understand, for this young boy, that probably gave him a lot of fear and trepidation. Moving to new areas that you don't know is a scary, exciting, but scary thing. And so the scariest part of that with really any move is that first time you go back, that you go to school. You don't know anybody. You don't know your teachers. You don't know a single face there. And yet you're somehow supposed to create your own little existence, your own little subculture in this place. So this boy goes to school, goes to elementary school, doesn't know anybody there, goes through his first few classes, doesn't really talk to anybody. And then he hits the cafeteria. You get all your food, you get that slop they throw on your plate, and then you turn, and that's the scariest part, because now you're looking at a sea of children and lunch trays and seats, and you don't know where your place is. At least in class, they kind of said, hey, you sit here. But now you're in the cafeteria and you don't know where you're at. You don't know your place. And so the little boy takes his tray and he makes his way to the back room of the cafeteria and he sits down, starts eating his lunch by himself. A few minutes go by and this little girl his age comes up to him and says, are you new here? And he's like, yeah, I am. She goes, can I sit with you? And he's like, I'd be more than happy to have somebody. I'm sure he didn't talk like that. He's a little boy. But you know what I'm saying? Yeah, please sit with me. He was more than happy to have somebody sit and have lunch with him just to make some sort of interpersonal connection. So they got talking. They had some common interest, probably Pokemon or something like that. The next few classes go by, they find they have a few classes together. And so he's excited to go home and tell mom and dad, I made a friend today. So that week, Monday through Friday, he gets to hang out with this little girl every chance he gets. They're in some of the same classes. They got cafeteria together. Sunday rolls around. Understand, still new neighborhood. They have to go to church for the first time. Still sort of a scary kind of thing. Dad walks into the Sunday school classroom, opens up the door and says, hey, my son's new here. And he looks in, and who does he see but that little girl, right? And he's super excited. He's like, I know somebody. I've got at least a connection. I've got somebody I can sit by. And so because of this proximity, they're close to each other. They grow up together. They're in church together. They're in school together. They get to know each other really, really well. They end up doing middle school together, high school together. They share a lot of the same activities just because of the way their families are close and their church life is close and their school life is close. And like, and just they're the best of friends. Youth group stuff, weekend stuff, lake stuff. He's made a best friend. Graduation comes. They go to the same university in their local town there. And they continue this friendship, not as children anymore, but as adults. 4 years goes by, and they start to do what adults do when they start to look to graduate. They start taking job interviews, and they start thinking, what am I going to do now that I'm going to have to be doing this thing on my own? And this young boy, now young man, is going through this time, this season in his life, and he says, and he starts thinking to himself, oh my word, I've known this young girl my entire life. My every memory is with this young girl. And as up to this point, they've just been friends, and he's never looked at her as anything other than that. But she's looking at jobs on the West Coast, and I'm looking at jobs on the East Coast. And he's like, this can't be. I don't want to spend the rest of my life without her. And so for the first time, he feels these feelings of attraction, you know, those feelings that adults feel when they get with somebody else, right? When boys and girls spend a lot of time together. And so he says, when I graduate, I don't want to spend the rest of my life without this young girl, without her by my side. So he calls her up and he says, hey, we're going to be graduating soon. We're going to be doing life soon. Can we go celebrate? Can we go just go celebrate our lives together before, you know, one little last hurrah? Can we do that? She's like, yeah. He's like, listen, just dress nice. I want to make this a big celebration. I'll take you to a nice restaurant. So the night comes and he picks her up. They go eat a nice restaurant, probably cost more than he made as a college student in a week. But that's what you do when you're in love, right? Has a ring that he bought. They go eat. And then he says, do you mind if before I take you home, we do this little excursion thing? She's like, no, that'd be awesome. So he had this all planned out, and he takes her to the cafeteria. And he walks her back to the table. He's like, do you remember this table where we first met? Do you know how excited I was just to have somebody to talk to me? She's like, yeah, that was amazing. It just all started right there. And then he takes her to that Sunday school room. He's like, do you remember that time I walked? He's like, you don't even know how excited I was when I walked through that door and I saw somebody I knew. She's like, that was crazy, right? It's like the carpet hasn't even changed. It's the same place we were when we were little kids. So he takes her on through these other areas, the high school football field, where because they were in band together and they did all these things together. And just walks her through their lives together. All the memories, the inside jokes. So he says, do you mind if I take you one more place? So she's like, no, that's fine. Before I take you home, I'll take you one more place. So he takes her out to the lake, the little city lake there where they did boating and kayaking and fishing for years. It was a spot that they both would have known well. It's dark now, and there's a single pier that goes off into the lake with a light at the end of it, real romantic. So he walks her out there, and he starts into his little, probably mixing up his words a little, because now he's nervous. And he starts, listen, we have all these memories together. And I've done life as much as I can with you as I've done with anybody else. And I know you're planning on hitting the West Coast, and I'm thinking about hitting the East Coast, and we're going to do this adult thing. But I don't want that. I don't want to spend another day of my life without you. And he drops down on one knee, opens up that box, pulls out that ring, and he says, will you marry me? And she looks down at this young boy, now a young man, who she known her entire life, and she says, stop it. You are making me uncomfortable. Take me home. Now, maybe you thought I was telling you the story of Ashley and I. That wasn't, because when I said, will you marry me, she said yes. But I will tell you that that is a story that is based very much on true events. All good stories are based in some sort of truth. As Christians, we live out this sort of relationship with God quite often. We have this relationship that's okay, but there comes to a point where he calls us to something that is uncomfortable, sometimes that we don't necessarily want to do. You see, in this story, a young man asks a young girl to do something crazy, right? Marriage isn't a cakewalk. If you're married, you know, it's not something easy. It's an adventure. And she doesn't even know this thing's coming. But he takes this risk and says, I don't want to live another day of my life without you. And I'm hoping you feel the same way. He does something crazy. But she replies back, I'm uncomfortable. Stop it. Let's forget this conversation ever happened. Much the same way, like it or not, the call of the Christian is often the call to do the uncomfortable. And this isn't something new for 2020. God has been calling individuals to do things that they are not comfortable doing since the beginning of time. One of our most basic functions as a Christian, literally one of the most basic functions of our Christianity, is that of the Great Commission. We find that in Matthew 28:19, where Jesus tells his disciples, go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. Still sort of an uncomfortable calling. It puts us out of our comfort zones. We have to do things, talk to people that kind of makes our skin crawl sometimes. It's not always what we want to do, but it's not new. So my favorite story, or at least one that really drives this point home of an uncomfortable calling and our reaction to that calling, comes in the Old Testament story of Moses, right? So if you'll turn in your Bibles, we'll be in Exodus 3:9. If I can take some cues here from Pastor Krell, 3:9. Exodus 3:9. And we're going to be working through our story where God calls Moses to leave his life of comfortable shepherding to free the Israelites out of bondage in Egypt. So Exodus 3:9, we're picking up in the story where Moses is in the desert taking care of his father-in-law's sheep, right? His father-in-law is Jethro. He's taking care of his sheep. And lo and behold, Moses is walking around and he finds this burning bush. Now, I'm not going to read that part. I think we probably all know what's going on. If you need to freshen up, go ahead and take a chance when you get home. But what I want to do is walk through the conversation that Moses is having with God. Because in this conversation, we get to learn a lot about the same excuses we use today when God calls us to do something uncomfortable. Something I try to remember when I'm reading through stories in the Bible are that the Bible characters are real people. A lot of times I think when we read these stories, we do it with this self-righteous sort of feeling, this Monday morning quarterback. Like if I was put in that situation, I would have handled that thing differently. Or we kind of chide the Bible characters for reacting the way that they did, because we forget that they're real people with real fears and real emotions. Understand, Moses isn't just a nice Bible story. He's a real dude being called by a very real God in a very real way. So with that being said, I want to remind you of what God is calling Moses to do, all right? So God's coming to Moses and saying, hey, I need you to go talk to Pharaoh. All right, Pharaoh's the highest ranking official in Egypt. You need to go tell him and say, hey, Pharaoh, you know those people, those thousands and thousands of people that you have working for you that build your buildings, that have built your Sphinx and your pyramids, and you don't have to pay them, and they just show up to work, and if they don't, you hit them a little harder, and then they work a little harder, and you don't have to do, you need to let them go. Right? That's what God's calling Moses to do. It wasn't going to be this nice little conversation. He was telling Pharaoh to get rid of his entire workforce, his entire economy. Let them go. Not a comfortable calling in the least. I think that's probably enough to make any of us uncomfortable, right? So let's pick up the conversation in chapter 3, verses 9 through 13. And now behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? But God said, I will be with you, and this shall be a sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. So right here we hit up on Moses' first excuse. Who am I? Who am I that you should send me? Let's not forget why Moses might be asking this question or posing this excuse. Do we remember the reason? Anybody? Why did Moses leave Egypt? What did he do? He murdered somebody, right? He murdered an Egyptian, right? So the punishment for his murder would have been capital punishment. Moses is a wanted man in the place of Egypt. And it's not that they didn't know it. We know that the people knew Moses did this because he gets called out on it back when he's in Egypt. His excuse is a reasonable excuse. He's asking, why me, God? You know I'm a wanted man. If I show up in Egypt, they're gonna kill me. It's reasonable. It makes sense. But when God makes a request of us, there's no room for excuses, not even reasonable excuses. And I like God's response in verse 12, right? But I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. It's not even really an answer. God merely reminds Moses that he will be with him. He says, look, on the other side of this, you'll know I was right. Just have faith in who I am. We often have legitimate questions and concerns as we navigate through our calling. But as we see here with Moses, it's not our job to question God's calling, but know that he will always be with us. He doesn't really bolster up Moses in any way. He doesn't say, I'm going to be with you. I'll be your mouthpiece. He says, you're going to look back and you're going to know I'm right. Let's do this. That's God's response. Let's do this. We, like Moses, may look back on our past lives and think, I'm not worthy to be used by God. And this thought process of unworthiness is nothing but a trap from the devil. He wants you to feel unworthy, held back by your past. And if we fall into the trap of saying to God, you can't use me today or tomorrow because of what I've done in the past, we've effectively made ourselves completely useless in the kingdom of God. If we can only hold ourselves back, and if that's our attitude, we're going to be held back. One of the craziest stories in the Bible, and we also know this story very well, and it's a long story, we get to read it throughout the entire New Testament, is this story of Paul, right? Paul's literally approving the murder of Christians, right? He's going around headhunting Christians, and he's saying, yep, get that guy, kill him. I saw him praying to Jesus, right? He's putting a signature on saying, let crucify that guy, stone that guy. This is Paul. So if anybody ever had a reasonable excuse to say, God, you can't use me, you don't know what my past is like, Paul had that. But that's not what it says. Acts 9:20 says, and immediately Paul proclaimed Jesus in the synagogues, saying, he is the Son of God. Paul doesn't make excuses. He is sure of who God is. He is sure of his calling and immediately goes to work spreading the gospel message. Our reaction to God's calling in our own lives should mirror Paul's life, Paul's reaction, but far too often mirrors Moses's excuses. Moving on back to Moses here. That little excuse Moses throws at God there should have been the end of the conversation. It should have been done. Moses should have saddled up, headed into Egypt. That's what should have happened. That's not what happened. So we move on then to Moses making more excuses. Excuse number two, what shall I say? Moses continues with these excuses. And in verse 13 of chapter 3, Moses asks, if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask, what is his name? What shall I say to them? Sometimes we today get caught up in the wondering about the hows of the sharing of the gospel are going to play out. We wonder what we should say and how we should say it and what's the best plan of attack and what's going to be the most effective way of conveying a certain message. But God gives a straight answer. Tell them, I am has sent you. This is my name forever, and thus I am to be remembered throughout generations. Notice here again, God doesn't take a whole lot of time to build Moses up. He's not building his ego. He's not assuaging his fear. He merely reminds Moses that Moses is talking to God. The Almighty God's answer here is more about reminding Moses, like, chill out. Chill out. Do you know who I am? I'm God, right? I got you. Just do what I'm saying. I will give you the words to say. And God goes on to tell Moses that he will work a miraculous work and that he will do mighty things to and through the Egyptians in a way that will make the Israelites a rich country. So he's like, not only am I going to do something big, but in this process, your people are going to be blessed. I'm going to bless you. And about this time, we start realizing something about Moses. Moses has something of a me complex. Moses hears God calling him to do something uncomfortable, and God tells Moses that he's about to do something crazy through Moses, and what does Moses hear? Moses hears, Moses, you need to talk to Pharaoh. Hey, Moses, you need to free the Israelites. Hey, Moses, you need to do mighty signs, wonders, and works. But that's not what God is saying to Moses. He merely wants Moses to be the vessel that God will use to do his will. This excuse, what shall I say, is probably the most prevalently used excuse in the church today when it comes to why we don't engage in active evangelism. If you ask any group of Christians, and they're being honest, and you say, why aren't you telling other people about Jesus? 9 times out of 10, they're going to come back and say, well, I just don't know what to say. So a while ago, I got a text message from one of my buddies. I think Scott probably got it. We're in this little group text message. We hold each other accountable and all this stuff. And he sent us this statistic that a Bible translator with Wycliffe or something like that was saying that in 10 years, the Bible is going to be translated into every readable, discernible language in the entire world. Every man, woman, and child will have access to the Bible, to the written word, and this is unprecedented. Has never happened. This is a miracle in itself, and it's something that we as Christians should be celebrating, right? But then here we are in America making excuses like, I don't know what to say about Jesus, right? But we're rolling around with the YouVersion app on our phone, and we have the NIV and the Revised NIV and the King James and the New King James and the ESB, and we have paraphrases like the Message and the New Translation, and then we say things like, I just don't know what to say. The only person we can blame for not knowing what to say when it comes to telling others about Jesus is ourself. And the excuse, I don't know what to say, just doesn't cut it. Just does not cut it. Because if we know what the Bible says, we know what to say. Moving on, even after these first two excuses, Moses is still not a convinced man. And he says, what if they don't believe me? Exodus 4:1. Then Moses answered, But behold, they will not believe me or listen to my voice, for they will say, the Lord did not appear to you. I think sometimes we do the same thing. Maybe we're not so worried about what to say. Maybe we've got a good grasp on what we're supposed to say, but we're more concerned or worried about what we say and how it's going to be received by somebody else. It'll make things awkward. I don't want to be that guy. What if they just don't want to be around me anymore? What if they think I'm a holy roller, right? We wonder how the message is going to be received. But how does God answer Moses here? This is the moment in the story, and we all know the story, I think, where God commands Moses to throw his staff down. And what happens? What happens? Moses chucks his staff. What happens? Turns into a snake, right? It says he runs away, but then God's like, hey, you need to pick that thing back up. Picks it back up, and it turns back into a staff. And then it goes on to say that Moses, God commands him to put his hand into his cloak, and he pulls it out, and now he's got leprosy. Put it back in, comes back, and it's clean, right? I'd like to think, now I'm going to do some Monday morning quarterbacking here now, biblically speaking. I think in this instance, I think I'd say, all right, you got me. Let's go to Egypt. I think. I don't know. I'm not there. Staff to a snake, leprosy, not leprosy. I think you got my attention now. But that wasn't the case with Moses. But regardless, what is God saying here? Ultimately, it's not our job to save anyone. We're just a vessel. Our success and failures are not measured by the amount of people we bring to a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ, but rather, are we willing to be used by God or not? That is how we are successful or unsuccessful. It didn't matter if Pharaoh listened to Moses. Now, we know he did. What mattered in that instance was Moses willing to be used by God? And in the same way, we worry about the reception of the gospel message and how it'll be received by our friends. And we say, well, maybe it won't be received well, or I don't have all the notches on my belt. And that's how we as humans like to measure successes and failures. How many people hit the altar, or how many people we brought to Jesus this past year. But real success and failure in the Christian life is much more derived from our willingness to just be used by God. Because if we're not even willing to be used, those numbers aren't even going to happen. We don't do the saving. We merely bring the gospel. God does the saving. God was the one who changed the staff into a snake and back, not Moses. And we need to trust that God will use our efforts and stop worrying what other people think. If God can change a staff into a snake, if God can change my life from what I used to be, or he can change your life from what you used to be into what the creature that you are today, God can still change other people that if we are willing to go with the gospel message. And Moses says here, and I'm paraphrasing, what about their unbelief? God, what if they don't believe me? But I think the big question here, what Moses is really asking is, God, what about my unbelief? Moses does not trust God enough to be used. Moses doesn't trust the words he's been given. Moses, after seeing crazy miracles performed one after another, still has doubts about what God can do. And I wonder today if we suffer from the same unbelief in the church. Excuse number 4. I'm not a capable person. Exodus 4:10. But Moses said to the Lord, and here's how I think it went. I'm not eloquent. Either in the past or since you spoke to your servant. I think he's laying it on thick here. But I am slow of speech and tongue, right? He's saying, I don't speak too good, God, so you can't use me. I got a speech impediment. You can't use me. Moses looks to his own physical limitations as an excuse as to why he is unable to fulfill the calling of God. Do we do this today still? Has God called us in some way that is bigger than us? And I think universally as Christians, that answer is yes. He has called us into something that is bigger than us. Perhaps there's a call to full-time ministry or missions or to do something here locally, inside the church, outside the church. But we make those excuses, like we say things like, I'm not smart enough, or I don't have enough resources for that. I'm not organized enough to even accomplish something like that, or I'm just not a very strong person to begin with. My personal thing is, I actually don't really speak well. Like, if I had an excuse, I'd say, God, I don't talk good. That's what I would tell God. If I was going to be making excuses here, that would be mine. I get my words mixed up all the time. All the time. I'm just not qualified. Perhaps you've heard the saying before, but I think it bears worth repeating. God doesn't call the equipped, he equips the called. The truth is, we are not smart enough. We are not strong enough. We are not rich enough or eloquent enough to do the things that we're often called to do. And that is exactly why we're called to do it. And if you just look at the Bible, it's just one example after one example of these little dudes doing big things. Gideon, the disciples, Moses, David, the run of the litter, Paul, right? Killing Christians. And today, still using people like you and me, super unworthy of the call, and yet he still calls us to further the kingdom. And why does he do this? Why does he pick these kinds of people? Hebrews 13, 20, 21 gives us the answer. Now may the God of peace, who brought again from the dead our Lord Jesus, the great shepherd of the sheep, by the blood of the eternal covenant, equip you. So who's equipping us? God is equipping us. Equip you with everything good that you may do his will, working in us that which is pleasing in his sight through Jesus Christ, to whom be glory forever and ever. We are called to do things that we possibly cannot do on our own, so that when impossible things happen, we know who actually did it. God gets the glory. Same thing here with Moses. Moses did not free the Israelites. God did. And we, and all there, all who are there, all who witnessed this, Pharaoh, the Egyptians, the Israelites, they all witnessed this thing and they say, Moses didn't do this. God did this. God alone did this. God's response to Moses now, and we can sort of hear God starting to get a little angry. In chapter 4, verses 11 and 12, he says, who has made man's mouth? Who made him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now therefore go, and I will be with your mouth and teach you what to say. So we see that God actually agrees with Moses. We're not capable of doing what we're called to do, but we serve a God who is able to do those things regardless through us. And in his graciousness, understand, this calling is a gracious thing that he allows us to be a part of, that he allows us to take part in something that's bigger than us, that is outside of us. This is a gift in itself that he gives to us, and we should be so humbled that he would pick us to do this. Excuse number 5. Send someone else. Here we see the very true heart of Moses. He was dancing, right? He was playing that little dance thing that we do when we don't want to do something, and we make up these tiny little excuses because we just don't want to do something. My kids do it, right? Like, you're like, hey, you need to, they're like, well, my leg hurts. No, you just don't want to clean your room, right? Moses said, oh, my Lord, please send someone else. Do you know what this sounds a lot like to me? Stop it. You're making me uncomfortable. Take me home. Let's pretend this conversation never happened. We do know that ultimately Moses does do what God calls him to do. And we do know that the Israelites are freed in a way that is only possible through God. We see God equip Moses through divine strength, through his people like his brother Aaron, and just through crazy miracles for just one after another. But in the same way Moses made excuses, I wonder if in 2020 we're making the same excuses for the call that God has put into our own lives. We are indeed a called people. We are called to go and make disciples. And if we know Jesus in a real personal way, then we are called to not necessarily live a life of comfort, which so many times we get busy doing, but rather we have a call to go and make disciples. The excuses that Moses used are still alive today. Maybe you've made them yourselves. I know I have personally made them myself from time to time. And those excuses are still found in the church. Those excuses are still alive in you, and they are still alive in me. And maybe we don't necessarily use these five excuses that Moses used. Maybe we just say, I don't have enough time. Maybe I just don't care. That person lives on the other side of the planet. There's no way I could have an impact on that person. But regardless, we are called to be ambassadors for Christ. What's so cool about this is that the way that plays out can be as different as every individual in here. We all have different strengths. We all have different weaknesses. We all come into contact with a different set of people every single day. And just as Moses was called to go and be instrumental in freeing the Israelites from Egypt, we too are called to be instrumental in the freeing of those around us from the bondage of sin. As I said before, our Christian success and failures are not determined by numbers. We're not going to get there to the pearly gates, and God's not going to say, "Hey, how many people did you save?" Now, numbers are important, and I don't want us to downplay the number of it, because if there's a church and within the last year you haven't had one person that you can say a person came to know, maybe something isn't right there. But numbers do not play the entire story. Numbers are a part of the story. But the big part of the story is, are we even willing today? And I think too many times the answer is no. We're making excuses. About 2 months ago, we issued a new year, 2020. Seems like forever ago. Maybe you made some New Year's resolutions. Maybe you forgot them. Maybe you broke them. Whatever. Right? And that seems like a really exciting time of the year with new promises and everything like that. But today, I would just call you to a new resolution, a new resolve, a divine resolution, if you would. For the year 2020, take hold of the calling upon your life. If you don't know what that looks like, that's fine. The Bible tells, go and make disciples. That's ultimately what we need to be doing. Like I said, that looks different for every person. But we have to be willing to go into our workplaces, into our schools, at the supermarket, at Dunkin' Donuts, when you're tipping your waitress. It's going to look different for every person, but the call is the same for each individual. So this year, let's be a community of believers that not only shares the gospel story once a year or when it's convenient. I was reminded quickly of Scott. Last week told us that every 6 months, it's like 38%, 37% of Christians, every 6 months tells one person about Jesus. That means 70 some odd percent aren't, and that only two people per year per 38% of Christians are telling. So numbers aren't the whole story, but they're an important part of the story. So here, this year, 2020, I would encourage that here at Mifflinburg Nazarene, that you would be a people, a whole community that doesn't say, stop it, God, you're making me uncomfortable, but rather that you would wholly embrace the challenge of Christianity and that we would all truly live a life of evangelism without excuses. Thank you.